Frank Hamai, the natural nurse at www.naturalnurse.com, right here on Progressive Radio Network. And we've been a part of Progressive Radio Network since its inception. We're very happy to be a part of the Gary Null Network, which brings you cutting-edge information about a vast array of topics in natural living today. And one of the great things about Progressive Radio is that it's available 24/7 because you can listen to our show, The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m., and you can listen anytime, day or night, at your leisure by going to progressiveradionetwork.com and looking in the archives. And, of course, there's all kinds of other shows there, Gary Null's shows and many of the other host shows, all of which will keep you abreast of what's new, what's important in your life in terms of being the best you can using natural remedies. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We do have a guest with us, and he is Don Hassig. And Don is the director of the Cancer Action Network in New York and also Cancer Action New York. And, in fact, his website is canceractionny.org. And we are going to talk to Don today about the importance of the science and evidence-based information that helps to support education for you and your family about the importance of minimizing the release of carcinogenic pollutants into the environment. Don also carries on the ancient oral traditions of the ancient poets who focused on a deep connection and honoring of the natural world. So I want to thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Good morning, Ellen.
How are you doing, Don? Yeah, it's just about afternoon now, but you know, you never know when people are listening in to the archives, so they could be listening in Europe and China, who knows when. So anytime that you say day, night, good morning, good evening, it's all the same.
Well, it's morning somewhere. That's the nice thing about it.
Exactly. It's morning somewhere. Now, tell us about your history a little bit. What got you involved in looking into starting a website and being an activist and telling people about the concerns of carcinogens?
Well, truly, the very first kind of essay that I made into the realm of environmental activism was back in the 1980s. There was a proposal to construct a countywide solid waste incinerator here in St. Lawrence County, upstate New York, on the St. Lawrence River. And the problem with that proposal was, in the beginning for me, that the high impact area of the emissions, you know, the air emissions, you know, where they're going to hit the ground at the worst levels, was very close to this farm, this very special family farm that my brothers and I and our parents lived on back in those years. And so, you know, we just, it wasn't this thing of, you know, being a person that saw themselves, as I now do, as a leader in environmentalism. It was more this, don't, you know, ruin my wonderful farm kind of start there. And then I went on from that. There was a hazardous, it's amazing how many troubles have come along in these environmental matters for our region. A hazardous waste site, it's probably not well known, but it was a very significant site. It was the Sealand Superfund hazardous waste site. It was located in the town of Lisbon, which is the township in which our farm exists, probably about a mile or two from, you know, our land. The water moves under the ground, as I've learned, toward the St. Lawrence River, so we were between, you know, this dumping site, this horrible dumping site, and the St. Lawrence River, so our water was, you know, possibly in line for getting impacted.
Well, what made you even go to look at it in the first place?
Well, I heard radio reports about it. I heard and I read some newspaper reports about it. Just started hearing about this hazardous waste site. It was strange. I was, involved with other matters. I was trying to deal with veterinary school and stuff like that, and I didn't do veterinary school. It just didn't work out. But anyways, I wasn't, functioning all that well, and so this hazardous waste dumping took place. Never even knew what was going on until it was all over. And then started hearing these very brief and limited reports about the hazardous waste dumping. It was this midnight hazardous waste dumping. very late in the days of that in the U.S.
So somebody took the time to actually go there in the middle of the night.
Oh, yeah.
Doing it during the day when someone might see them do that.
Exactly, yeah. They were bringing tanker trucks up to this little old dairy farm, this kind of abandoned dairy farm, and dumping that on the surface. They're burying barrels and dumping into a thing they call the waste disposal pit. It wasn't lined. It was just a hole in the ground near a swamp. Very, very bad. You know, my friends, I went to school with this one guy.
Was there a name on the truck that was coming, or was it just a city truck?
There were trucks from all over the place. It came from all over. You know, there were just all kinds of companies, you know, and corporations that brought their hazardous waste there and dumped it. There was a long list of all the various, they call them the PRPs, the potentially responsible parties. And on the long list of big names like Ashland Chemical, and it's been a long time. I can't even remember some of the names, just a bunch of big companies. Anyways, that's where I started, and it didn't tell me.
So did you sneak over there at night and watch them do this, or you just read the reports?
Just read the reports. I wish I had later on, once I got more involved in it, I actually remember one time telling one of the guys that, you know, made it happen. He was a local guy that ran this kind of excavating kind of trucking business, and he knew what was going on. He was right there in the middle of it, never got in any hot water or anything. It's a strange mix of government that we have up here. Anyways, this guy by the name of Pete Green was, you know, right in the middle of it. I called him one day and talked to him for a while, and I said, you know, Pete, if only I had known you guys were doing that back then, I certainly would have been out there with my 30-06 and I shot the tires out of those trucks and been sitting there still. But it didn't happen because I never knew about it until it was all over.
Okay, so that's how you started. You heard about it, and then what was the next action step that you took?
Getting around and talking to the neighbors, you know, the people that lived in close there, you know. I knew this one guy. He got into high school with him and rode the school bus with him. His name was Dale Moncrief. He had a family of about 3 or 4 kids at that time and a wife. And they were living there, and he said to me, I stopped by, and I said, do you know anything about this? He said, I've been hearing more and more about it. I hear those drilling rigs back there, you know, on the site, drilling the test wells to, like, figure out how bad the groundwater is. Because, you know, I think it was EPA, had some drilling rigs in there. Anyways, about the time that drilling got going, this guy's water went to hell. You know, he had this spring, this very unusual surface water spring. He thought it was fed by aquifers or something because it would never go dry, no matter how bad a drought. And we used to get these wicked droughts in the San Lawrence River Valley back 10, 20 years ago. And that spring would always, you know, provide the water for the house there and the family. And that spring, he started telling me that it tasted awful. And one time I smelled it. I would never drink it. I can't imagine why they drank it when it was so awful. But they did. And that water, it smelled exactly like the water in the wash basin after you've washed your hands when you've changed the oil in your car. You know, it was just awful smelling stuff. And yet the Department of Health, New York State DOH, says, there's nothing wrong with that water. There's nothing wrong
now,
with water.
Do you know for a fact that they came and tested it?
They came and tested it, and they found DEHP, a plasticizer, in it one time.
Okay, and what is that?
It's a chemical that causes, I'm not certain if it's carcinogen or not, but it's a nasty chemical. It's you know, it's certainly something that you wouldn't want in your water. They claimed it was an artifact. It was only there because of the DEHP that's in the plastic in their testing equipment. So it was like this, you know, this round robin kind of thing, you know. We were saying it was from the site, and they were saying it wasn't. And the fact of the matter is, they don't know what was in that water because the way water testing works, you have to know what you're looking for before you find it. You have to test for one specific chemical and another specific chemical and then another specific chemical. They dumped so many chemicals in there, and they did it in the middle of the night, and who knows what they dumped in there. So they sure didn't test for all these specific chemicals that could well have been that guy's water. And there was something in it. You know, it was certainly not spring water anymore. Once that waste dumping got done, and once EPA punched those drill holes down there.
So that's what interested you. You're thinking back of one of the beginning things that interested you.
Right, certainly. That was when I started. I had this group called the Sealand Abused Health Action Group, and we did a health survey of the residents around there, and nobody paid any attention.
Now, how would you do that kind of health survey?
Got in the car. Well, no, first of all, typed up. You know, that was back in the old days before we didn't have computers.
Right, no computers, right.
Typed up a little health survey, you know, asking these people, like, basically, What's your health like? Did it change when this dumping, you know, after this dumping has gotten done? You know, what's your family's health like? What kind of, you know, medications do you have to have? You know, this kind of, you know, just learning as much as we could about what was going on in their bodies. And then we took it around and hand-delivered it and went back and picked it up. And some people filled it out and some people didn't. And it was just a place where the, you know, lots of people were kind of uptight about real estate value and all this kind of jazz. And so it didn't turn out as well as, you know, you'd hope the media would have jumped on it and it would have all been a good result. But a lot of work and barely made a difference, you know. Those people, they got bottled water for a little while, and then that stopped. And they're on their own right now. And guy, this Dale Moncrief in particular, I don't know, his family's had a lot of health problems. And nobody ever figured out he had this itching condition that, in the literature, it describes this, that one of the effects of the DEHP exposure, this diethyl hexaphthalate, that can cause itching. We tried to get the MDs around here to think about that and kind of assess it, and they said he had the heebie-jeebies. You know, they don't get it. You know, they don't pay any attention to chemical exposure and disease or anything like that.
And why do you think that is?
Because
they don't pay any attention to that.
They haven't experienced it enough, really. It's kind of new in some ways with some of these doctors. You know, up here in the North Country, there's not a whole lot of, you know, there was that hazardous waste site. But as far as, there's a few big industries and stuff, but there isn't, most of their clientele, most of their, you know, their patients are not people that have had, you know, any real obvious heavy-duty chemical exposure. So they don't know about that, and I don't think they teach much about it in medical school either.
So you think that there's just no knowledge about the fact that these toxic chemicals can be known carcinogens if they affect people that come in contact with them?
The only place where that knowledge exists right now to any extent at all is in, say, organizations like, and it's not an organization, it's government. Say it's like the ATSDR, Agency for Toxic Disease and Substance Registry. That organization knows about the chemicals. They know what their research, you know, the scientific research basis of what adverse health effects they cause. They know about how much exposure is involved. They do these things called toxicological profiles on many, many, many chemical substances and whether they cause cancer or whether they cause, you know, diabetes or other chronic diseases or acute effects. They have a lot of information in these tox profiles. They're very large books, and you know, what doctors get the time to read through those things? They're working on it. They're now doing these basically like the Reader's Digest version of that kind of thing. And I just learned about that a couple of days ago, so it's good that we can share this with the listeners. And
what
now,
is that? So tell us that again, since that's some new information.
It's the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. And if you want to call a guy by the name of Dr. Bruce Fowler, he could explain how to get a hold of these kind of Reader's Digest kind of format. It's much more simplified and brief tox profile on some of these chemicals like dioxins or benzene or PAHs or the DEHP. Or, you know, we could spend the whole rest of your show just naming these chemical compounds, and that would be a waste of time. So ATSDR is good. They're part of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. It's really the New York State Department of Health knows this stuff, but they're no good in my book to be very nice to them. And they know the chemicals cause these diseases, have that research basis available at their fingertips, and yet due to political kind of concerns, see, the way it works is this. The New York State DOH has to be concerned about the constituency of the people that deal with budgeting their part of government. And so if you got say, these kind of health-oriented legislative people that don't have constituents that are really concerned about pollutant exposure and disease, then you're not going to get a good result from DOH, and that's what we have right now. That's the status of the political situation as far as chemical exposure and disease go in New York State.
Well, let's talk about some of the very specific carcinogens that you've discovered, particular kinds of information about. Like, for instance, Benzene. Let's talk a little bit about benzene. Where does that come from, and what does it do to our health?
Benzene is a volatile organic compound. They call it VOC. It doesn't last all that long in the, right out in the environment. So if you know just a little bit of it going into the air, occasionally, it would break down, and it wouldn't be nearly the problem that it is. But see, we put so much benzene into the air that even though it doesn't stay there all that long, it's still a problem. It's there long enough for us to breathe it, get it into our lungs, have it become a part of our bloodstream. When we get a respiratory exposure to benzene, we end up having benzene in our blood, and that means there's benzene in our cells, and benzene is a, you know, a carcinogen, an initiator of carcinogenesis that can damage DNA. And so when the cars are running, when the trucks are running, when the chainsaws and the ATVs and the snowmobiles and all that jazz, when they're all running and burning these hydrocarbon fuels, the benzene is merely six carbon atoms and then a certain kind of electronic configuration that involves this double bonding kind of complexity that we're not going to get into. It's an aromatic structure. It's a ring structure. It's just a simple chemical. It's all it is those six carbons with a few hydrogens on it. That's all it is. And it can be made very readily in any kind of combustion process. It's a part of every time you breathe that exhaust smell. When you smell exhaust, you're breathing benzene, baby. You know, that's the story.
So where are some of the other sources? What about, I know that soda, for instance, and various kinds of liquids are preserved with something called potassium or sodium benzoate. And I have been reading that when these compounds come into contact with something that has a heavy antioxidant activity, that those benzene rings you just described are actually pulled out and they are in the solution.
I'm not real familiar with that, but it sounds like it sounds like chemistry that's reasonable and understandable to me. So it's highly likely that you're correct in that.
Well, actually, the soda companies, you know, the soft drink companies, are being sued by parent groups because of the link to those benzoates to childhood cancers.
Very interesting. I think I know a lot about cancer, and I do, and I study it just endlessly. And I was thinking that I would try to be the cancer reporter, but the truth of it is, it's such a huge subject. Nobody could, even one person probably couldn't spend 24/7 and be even a cancer reporter when it's crazy. You know, how do we ever get to this place where there are so many chemicals, and even if we knew what the effect of every individual one of them was, as far as even cancer goes, that's a huge amount to know. And yet, what about the effects of the multiple exposures and the different times of exposure? This is so crazy that we let it get this far without having a revolution, you know.
I have to agree with you. Now, you also have a lot of information on your website at canceractionny.org about a lot of these carcinogens, where people are exposed to them, and also, you know, good ways to attempt to avoid them. Let's talk a little bit about polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons.
PAHs for short. Let's call them that from now on. The PAHs are released right along with the benzene in the exhaust. And it's not just exhaust, because that's, you know, thinking machines. PAHs are produced in any kind of fire, you know, just any kind of organic fuel combustion. When I say organic, I certainly don't mean the nice organic of organic food. It's just that the chemists use the word organic in a different way. Organic means carbon. You know, it's just, I like to say hydrocarbon, because then you're not messing up that word that people associate with good food, and you're also putting the blame on the bad guys, because truly the hydrocarbons, the way they've turned out for us, you know, with the oil and the gas and the tar sands, and we've got to get away from the hydrocarbons. And so I really like it when we, you know, people are, would maybe begin to call these pollutants not persistent organic pollutants, but persistent hydrocarbon pollutants. So maybe I'll accomplish that little change in the linguistics someday here. But as far as the PAHs go, they're ubiquitous in the environment. You know, they're out there. They last longer than the benzene. The benzene is a volatile organic compound. The PAHs are these semi-volatile organic compounds. So they don't break down as readily. They're not, you know, going to disappear as quickly. They're more associated with particulate matter. Say when you have a fire, a real sooty fire, soot is PAHs.
Okay, soot, like something like black. You know,
black, yeah.
That is burned.
Okay. Black of the soot. These PAHs first became known. They're this classical carcinogen. Benzoapyrene is the name of one of the many PAHs. The first time people knew that caused cancer was with the chimney sweeps of England when they developed cancer of the scrotum way back in the 1800s. You know, many years ago now, we've known that the benzoapyrene caused cancer. And yet
it's something that's been tracked many, many years in terms of its carcinogenic effects.
Established beyond any kind of question whatsoever that it's a known human carcinogen. It's listed that way with the National Toxicology Program. Any reasonable person that had read in the research literature would consider it to be thus. And that's the story. And yet, why is it that when I go to a local government and try to get them to just put up some very, very low-key, gentle signage asking people not to idle their vehicles, this is the problem, we don't really want to do that. So they'll have these bans, or not a ban even, they'll talk about having an idle-free zone around some of these buildings, maybe, but not certainly not in the whole village or certainly not in the whole county. And certainly we won't really even do the signage. We'll just kind of, we'll talk about it and we'll say we did it and maybe we'll hand out some brochures or something, but we just cannot be there as far as having a sign that says, please don't idle your vehicle. And I'm thinking if they would just do that, then the people would be thinking about the idling and wondering why it wasn't a good idea to do it. And then they would ask some questions and they'd pretty quickly, they could go to our website, for example, find out pretty quickly that benzene, formaldehyde, PAHs, they're all in that exhaust that is being put out totally unnecessarily when it's idling. There's no justification whatsoever for idling. I don't care how cold it is.
So you're talking about a car idling, sitting there and just running.
Yeah.
What happens when that goes on?
You're putting out these PAHs and benzene at even a worse rate than when you're running steadily on the highway.
Is that why somebody, can sort of commit suicide by running their car in their garage?
That's carbon monoxide. It's
a different
chemical.
Yep.
They would die.
Released from idling.
Yep. They would die from the carbon monoxide. It just kind of fouls up your lungs. It makes it, I think the way it does is just kind of so much of that gets in your lungs that, it doesn't work out as far as like the oxygen exchange and all that stuff that goes on in a normal lung. But these chemicals are there too, The problem is you're breathing this cocktail, this very complex cocktail, depending on the kind of engine, depending on the kind of fuel, depending on the kind of age of the engine and the operating condition of the engine. So many factors involved. And yet we just let those things play where we breathe, and nobody, it's crazy. They're not horses. They're not dogs and cats. They, you don't want to breathe their poop. It's just really awful,
So these are things that are known by scientists to be in the air and in the water. Now, what about dioxin? I know you have a lot of really good scientific research, for instance, from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, National Toxicology Program, about dioxins.
Yep. The dioxin has been listed as a known human carcinogen in this thing they call the ROC, the Report on Carcinogens. It's required by Congress to be done every 2 years by the NTP, the National Toxicology Program. They published that several years ago. They published the one that said this one particular dioxin, the most potent and most carcinogenic, as far as the research literature describes, of all the dioxins, this 2,4,7,8 tetrachlorodibenzopyridoxin. It's kind of hard to think that and say it under the little slight stress of an interview. Well, that's what it's called. It's called TCDD for short, tetrachlorodibenzopyridoxin. See, the dioxins are a whole family of chemicals, and there's many of them, and the differences largely depend on where these chlorine, which is an element, where these chlorine molecules are attached to the dioxin. And the dioxin is just two of the benzenes. So when we're talking benzene, there's that potential there for making the dioxin. There's some chlorine around in the fire. There's some metal there to catalyze the dioxin formation. Get more of the dioxin. So these fires, we just keep coming back to that. a lot of kind of bad results from fires. So certainly we should someday come to only use them ceremonially, and, you know, just have these ceremonial fires and maybe a campfire to get warm when you're out in the bush or something. But or just burning a bunch of stuff to either get rid of it or to go someplace, it'll be good when we put that behind us. And dioxins, the research literature is just huge on that.
Well, tell us some very specific studies, because not everybody knows that it's so well studied.
Let's talk about the one that I'm the most excited about. Well, two. We'll talk about the two most exciting ones. Dr. Marcella Warner at the University of California, Berkeley, in 2002 published this paper. I don't remember the exact name of it, but I can come pretty close. It's something about the Seveso Woman's Health Study. It was it was serum dioxin levels in the Seveso Woman's Health Study. That'll get you there. You know, if you'll web search that, you'll find this. Basically, it looked at women that were exposed to a mega dose of dioxin that was released by a factory explosion in Seveso, Italy, back in the, I think, in the 70s. It's quite a while ago now. There's this awesome book written about it called The Chemical Scythe. You know, it's just such a poetic and powerful name. It really, and I read that book. It was just totally awesome. Alice, I can't remember, well, I guess I better not say what the author's name was. But it was The Chemical Scythe. It was about this factory explosion in Seveso, Italy, that released this very large quantity, kilogram quantities. And kilogram quantities are major, major, major for dioxin, because it's truly active biologically at the parts per trillion level in the human body. We're talking about minute quantities. So kilogram amounts were just, like, unreal. Anyway, these ladies got exposed to this stuff, and then they followed up and checked their blood levels and kept track of it. And then they looked at how much breast cancer they had. There was a statistically significant association, you know, statistically significant link between the higher the dioxin levels in the blood, the higher the breast cancer rates in the people, you know. So, you know, that was a really, really powerful study that showed that adult women can be exposed to dioxins and it elevates their breast cancer risk. It was statistically significant amount, and that's what really matters. I don't remember how much it was. But
okay, so they knew through that study that it did in fact increase the rate of those specific kinds of cancers.
Exactly. You could say dioxin is a breast carcinogen. Another study that showed this even more, and it was actually more concern raising, because it gets to this whole question of why girls are getting breast cancer now. This study was done in 2002 as well. Well, it was not done then, but it was reported in the research literature in 2002. Who knows how long it took them to do it. But anyways, in 2002, Dr. Suzanne Fenton and Dr. Linda Birnbaum, and it's just so wonderful to have Dr. Birnbaum now at this National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences. She's a new director of that. I think she's going to be a great dioxin lady here in the U.S. someday. Well, she certainly already is, actually. But anyways, their study looked at when mother rats were exposed to dioxins, then the female offspring were predisposed to develop breast cancer. And what that means is that any exposures that initiate breast cancer in the offspring, you know, once they're born, or even before for that matter, but in the offspring, when they're exposed to breast carcinogens, they're at a higher risk of getting breast cancer because of that dioxin exposure in utero, you know, before they're born. So girls are being predisposed now, if they're the same as rats, to get breast cancer before they've been born, you know. And that's just so horrible. We felt like there should be an environmental revolution just based on that alone.
Well, what exactly does your group hold meetings, or how do you get all this information out to people who are interested in it?
That was a question I was going to ask you. How do we get this information out to people that are interested in it? You know, we've been trying, and we're a small group. We have zero budget. The only reason I'd like to honor my dad right for a second here, he's got Alzheimer's. He's, you know, not long for this world, and I took him up to a Native American, you know, kind of healer, up in Gatineau, Quebec. It's not far from where we live. Ottawa is only about 60 miles north of us. And the native healer said, "Dad, you ought to be really proud. You know, Bill Hessig, you ought to be a proud man when you're dying here, because your two sons, you know, have done these great things for the earth. And, you know, the only reason I can do it, I'm perfectly willing to state this for everybody on earth to know, I wasn't okay enough to do the full shot, you know, take care of myself, pay the bills, do this work that I believe in doing. Dad funded the you know, kind of like the doing it, so I really need to honor him in this, too. And so, yeah, we're just doing it the best we can with, you know, all things considered. And we want to do more, but, you know, it's hard to get it done. And we're trying, we try to get government to do it. I was just talking to this guy this morning, doing an interview with a guy that's working on tar sands and trying to get the Canadian government to deal with that shit the way it'd be dealt with. I asked him, my last question was, and it was a surprise question, I said, how do you draw the line between how much time you spend working directly one-on-one trying to educate people and trying to educate government and getting them to do part of the work? Because it just seems like they just won't do it. There's just this horrible obstacle. I'll bet you if I'd spend all the time educating people on my own rather than spending about half it trying to get government to do some of the educating, much, much, much more educating would have been done, because they've been trying since 2003 to get the no good New York State Department of Health just to tell people that dioxins are in food other than wild-caught fish, tell them the dioxins are in every animal bite, you know, that has any fat in it that they put in their body or put in their kid's body. No, they said, no, we don't think you want to tell people that, even though they know every bit of this that I've told you, because I provided it to them myself, let alone whatever they would have done on their own, you know. But they won't do it. There's only one reason for that. It's government by industry, where the food industry rules, and we get out of DOH just what the food industry wants them to feed us.
So you feel that it's a little bit frustrating because the facts are actually right there, and yet it seems like people are not willing to make any changes or take any action.
It's amazing. Everybody, I say dioxin to them, they think I'm some kind of Martian, you know. It's crazy that people think that dioxin is some kind of like scare word or like some kind of, you know, creepy, freaky word. Jeez, don't they ever read the newspapers? Or like, what about, you know, it was used in Vietnam. It's strange. Right up here,
it was really used in Vietnam. What was it used in Vietnam for?
It was an Agent Orange. It was
Agent Orange.
It wasn't totally deliberate. It was partially deliberate. See, they knew it was in there when they were doing it, and they knew it had some adverse effects. They kept doing it anyways because it was the Vietnamese and not us. It's kind of awful what they did with the Agent Orange. It's a chemical. It's these, let me get this right. It's these, just right on the tip of my tongue. It's just another chemical name. Well, 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. These, another short name for it. Yes, they're acetic acids. Well, I'm not going to waste time on it. Whatever. They're just commonly used pesticide. You know, we put plenty of it on the U.S., you know, before they knew it had the dioxin in it. So, you know.
What I heard, I was in Arizona, in a town outside of Globe, Arizona.
Yep.
And they said that before they actually were using it in Vietnam, that it had been tested in the fields.
Yep.
In Arizona. And as a result, hundreds of local people got various neurological diseases, cancer, and a host of unexplained health issues.
Well, they tested it right up here at Fort Drum, too. This Fort Drum is a real big Army base located about, I don't know, 50 miles from where I'm at. And that was the first place Agent Orange was ever tested in the U.S. It was on this Fort Drum, you know. And who knows what it caused there. And that's the thing. People just don't talk about these things, and they don't kind of like, you know, nothing's ever heard of it. I never even knew that Fort Drum had Agent Orange applied to it until I was on some environmental group's website or something, you know. And I just found out about it recently, really.
Oh, you just found out that it was part of the dioxin?
No, I've known that for years and years and years and years. Yeah, see, this whole thing, that chemical science book, it says, I'm pretty sure it describes some of that. There's just a huge amount of, you know, like, kind of both novels, well, not novels, but kind of like documentary-type things, and much, like, say, books, research articles, all kinds of stuff on this Operation Ranch Hand. That was what they called it when the aerial spraying of the defoliant. So they did it because it works well. And the reason that chemical was used, they weren't using it for the dioxin effect of it. They're using it as an herbicide to defoliate the jungle, you know, so it was easier to see the VC, you know. And so it wasn't like they were just deliberately dumping dioxin on those people. They weren't that bad. They knew there was some dioxin in it because I'm certain the way I recall what I read about, you know, that operation was that eventually Dow, you know, Dow Chemical Company, was aware of the fact that it had a pretty heavy-duty dioxin contaminant. And see, it's the way the chemistry is done. These are all very complex matters. They make that some of those chemicals still, but they do it in a different way so it doesn't have as much dioxin as a contaminant in the, you know, the batch of the, you know, the chemical that's used as the herbicide. Oh, it's trichloroacetic acid, you know.
Yeah, yes. And that's one of the bad guys. Now, I know you have a lot of information listed at canceractionny.org, and I'm looking at this interesting study, which is from the Institute of Medicine Dioxin Report. So obviously this is not obscure. You have a study there called Dioxins and Dioxin-like Compounds in the Food Supply, Strategies to Decrease Exposure. Now, why would the Institute of Medicine be interested in this?
Because the huge problem. The EPA dioxin reassessment says that 1 in 1,000 excess cancer risk for every American that eats animal food just because of the dioxin exposure based on these epidemiological studies of people that made those pesticides and those guys that used them in Vietnam. All the epi science, you know, that came out of that demonstrated that a certain amount of excess cancer risk was associated with dioxin exposure. The Institute of Medicine knows that, and they did. I have no complaint against the Institute of Medicine whatsoever, other than maybe they should be working harder to get their message out, but, you know, people do what they do. But anyways, I one of a scientist that I honor tremendously is this Dr. David Carpenter. He's at the University of Albany's Institute for Health and the Environment. He's the head of that. I did a dioxin interview with him about 4 weeks ago on our radio program. It's www.radioforall.net, and you just go to our shows, his Cancer Action Network shows, and he's there. And he was, you know, he was one of the authors of that report. That book, when it came out in 2003, it was like a time bomb, you know. It was like wonderful, you know, to have that powerful information to set before people, that well set forth and everything. We used that, you know, that study and, you know, that report when we tried to move the New York State Department of Health to say that pollution causes cancer. They did a cancer control plan back in 2003. The first draft said pollution doesn't cause cancer. We didn't like that sound of that because it was a lie. So we fought with them over it. Had a press conference in Albany with NYPERG and Cancer Action New York and Citizens Environmental Coalition and one of the breast cancer groups, the Capital Region Action Against Breast Cancer. They're a very, very good group as far as pollution and breast cancer go. But they're the heart of the beast there in Albany. And we changed the DOH. It didn't change them internally, but it changed them externally. They changed their cancer control plan, so it said, we have a goal for 2010 of reducing exposure to, you know, environmental, they call them environmental exposures. I call them pollution exposures. Well, anyways, you know, it means the same thing. They said they were going to reduce exposure of New Yorkers by 2010. I want to see their report on how much they reduced the exposure. It's very little done.
Well, what kind of action steps have they taken to reduce exposure?
Well, for one thing, they started claiming it was the whole New York State government that was involved in this, not just DOH. So they're really laying, you know, placing the responsibility and the blame on the whole state government. And so far as all I know of, it really stands out. Like, the real hallmark thing they did do, and I honor them for that, and I don't want to, like, you know, not honor them when they deserve honor. On the 14th, or, well, actually, there's a little bit of question in my mind yet, but in the middle of October, certainly no later than about the 16th of October, the New York State DEC's ban, regulatory ban, on burning trash that produces more dioxin now than any other process, any other, you know, thing that happens on the earth, that ban goes into effect for all of New York State. The farmers can't do it as they wanted to. We have to think about these things, too. You know, why do farmers, these people that we trust to make food for us, that are supposed to care about the health of their neighbors and their fellow New Yorkers and Americans, why do they continue to want to burn trash? And they know better because I have personally provided them much information about this, being whether it's these local farmers in the St. Lawrence County area or whether it's the New York Farm Bureau. I've provided much, much information. Talk to their representatives. Too much, really, about dioxins and food contamination and cancer risk. They continue to oppose a ban on open burning right to the very end.
And D.C. was tough enough and strong enough, they just ignored them.
Okay, so that's some good news, that we actually are moving in a legislative sense to...
Well, not legislative. Don't give the legislators any credit for this.
Okay.
Legislators tried to do this for years and years, and those horrible little bad boys in the New York State Senate were so bad before they really fell apart this last summer here, this last year. The bad boys in the New York State Senate are such a bunch of dinosaurs and corporate guys that they didn't care enough.
Listen, I just want to tell you we have to bring this to a close. We have to end today at 1:45. So I want to thank you so much for being our guest right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And I do want to tell people how they can get in touch with you and your organization. And that is, you can get in touch with our guest, Don Hussig, and he is the director of Cancer Action New York. And you can find out more at www.canceractionny.org. And thank you so much for joining us today, Don.
Thanks, all.